News Talk Breakfast with Anton Savage.
In association with AIR.
In talking throughout the programme about the implications of the Israeli and American attacks on Iran and what that means for the Straits of Hormuz, what that means for global trade in oil, and what that means for the Irish economy and for prices at petrol pumps and for prices of home heating oil. With us to discuss that and more is on Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Taoiseach, good morning.
Good morning, Anton.
We had, of course, last night Donald Trump giving a quasi sort of State of the Union, a 20-minute press conference where I think the market expectation was that he would draw a line towards the conclusion of the conflict. He didn't do that. In fact, he went back to issuing some of the threats that we've heard before. I'd like to get your reaction to that. Let's just remind ourselves of what he had to say.
We are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We are going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong. In the meantime, discussions are ongoing. Regime change was not our goal. We never said regime change, but regime change has occurred because of all of their original leaders' death.
So that was just a small sample of what Donald Trump had to say. That section where he talked about we're going to bomb them back to the Stone Age, this is doubling down on his promise that he's going to destroy the energy infrastructure across Iran. That, at the heart of it, is a war crime. What's your reaction to the...
I thought last evening he said he wasn't going to destroy the oil infrastructure later on in the speech. And I think this war should end.
But to threaten to bomb people back to the Stone Age, a direct attack on the civilian population. Yeah, that's nothing to do with it.
That's unacceptable. And every person involved in war has to prioritize civilian protection and innocent civilians. We all know that the Iranian regime was a very repressive one, a very oppressive one. But this war is creating death, destruction to people in Iran who have no act or part in the regime. And in fact, the level of support for that regime in Iran was as low as 20%, it's estimated. So for the people of Iran in the first instance, for the people in the Middle East, more generally, this war must end. And the world then, in addition to that, is on a precipice in terms of economic disruption of the most severe kind if this war is to continue for any considerable length of time at all.
But is there not a level of egregiousness greater than one could expect in what he said last night? I mean, it is one thing to say that there will be civilian casualties, unfortunate civilian casualties as a function of military action, but to publicly threaten to take action that can only damage the civilian population.
Well, that's wrong. It's not clear whether he's directing that at the civilian population.
You
could be forever trying to interpret President Trump in terms of what he said and what actually gets done, and that's always been a feature. But they have so far stopped doing the bombing of oil infrastructure. He said that would create that would damage their capacity to recover as a country. So I think both sides seem to know, and you know, the Iranians have hit the oil infrastructure, gas infrastructure in the Gulf states, for example. And that is problematic in terms of the capacity to restore those gas utilities and facilities in the Gulf and indeed in Iran. But also then you have the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. But more fundamentally, in terms of the human toll of this war, it should end. We have the effects also in terms of what Israel is doing in Lebanon, for example, which is wholly, wholly disproportionate in response to the unacceptable Hezbollah attacks. And there was a government in Lebanon endeavouring to try and emerge from the chaos there, and President Aoun had the support of the international community. UNIFIL was supporting the Lebanese armed forces. All of that has been undermined by appalling and reckless attacks on Lebanon by Israel, which is part of this wider war in the region.
In that context, what about our peacekeepers? Because our peacekeepers were originally there to maintain what was, as you described, that sort of developing democracy. It has now turned into a war zone. Is it worth exposing Irish Defence Forces to that level of risk to effectively be observers?
Well, I think the consequence of pulling out now would be very, very serious. in addition to what is already happening within Lebanon, in terms of the international community have eyes and ears in Lebanon through UNIFIL. And UNIFIL has been working with the Lebanese government and in terms of supporting the decommissioning and so on of Hezbollah before this war began, and also ensuring the observance of the ceasefire. Now, the ceasefire has been broken and Israel has just gone in now in response to Hezbollah rockets.
But that's my point. That was at the heart of the deployment. Yeah, is it worth remaining when that mission is now gone?
If you think, and one of the great setbacks in terms of Gaza, not strong enough a word, the lack of any international observance of what was happening in Gaza for so long. We all had a sense of the utter destruction and endless attacks on civilians within Gaza. We need to be careful that we would take out any international observance in Lebanon, because a similar fate could, particularly in South Lebanon, could await the inhabitants there if there is no one to hold Israel to account.
So in other words, it may stay the Israelis' hand if they know they're being watched?
That's a sense we have, and a sense a lot in the international community have. That the mere presence of UNIFIL is in itself a factor that can limit the nature and scale of Israeli attacks.
What then about the economic consequence of this? I'm intrigued by some of the language that you've used. You were quoted earlier saying that this may be the worst ever energy crisis since the 70s. You used the word "us standing on a precipice" a little earlier on in this conversation. You see it as being that significant a threat?
Well, absolutely. If this continues for any length of time, I think globally it will have very significant impacts on the world economy, livelihoods, and it'll have a range of secondary effects. The immediate one, obviously, is the supply shock that will occur. I'm talking globally now. But, of course, that then leads to inflation. It leads to a lot of products that are derived from oil and so on, fertilizer, plastics, helium for semiconductors, you name it, there's a whole range of secondary effects that will affect key sectors of the economy. Aviation, for example, is under threat as a result of jet fuel in particular being probably the earliest one that's been hit. This is all according to the IEA, the International Energy Agency, that are mapping and tracking this. So all of that has economic impact. And when you think that, you know, over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, we've had one shock after the other, Brexit, COVID, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, different to this crisis, but nonetheless created an energy disruption of a significant kind. Then we had the tariffs coming from the US, and now we have this war, and it's been endless, and cumulatively all of those will have impact.
Now, you talked about that being global. What then specifically of Ireland's situation? Because air access is so vitally important to us in terms of tourism and in terms of trade. And secondly, there will be people looking at the excise reductions that were put in to try to alleviate the pressures at the pump, and already seeing them being subsumed by the price increases. What are we staring in the barrel of?
Well, I think, first of all, we did take those measures to try and ease the pressure, but no government can compensate for a crisis of this kind in terms of every sector or every person's livelihood. So we have to try and target it at those who need it the most, and also try and ease the pressure of people generally at the fuel pump. But also then, we have to focus on protecting those that enable that are key to the, what I would say, the productive side of the economy. Hauliers are key to trade. Hauliers are key to getting food on our shelves and so on like that. And so that's why we took specific measures to help hauliers. We'll have to look at haulier food production as well, in terms of, you know, the fertilizer issue and costs there. Just like we did in COVID, if you remember, and it wasn't spoken about as much, but we kept industry going during COVID. We took specific measures in terms of enabling pharmaceuticals.
But what's your current analysis? Are you looking at those industries and saying there are going to need to be supports put in place in the coming weeks for the food industry, further supports for hauliers, further supports for
excise and fuel? Well, we've put supports in for hauliers. If this continues at length, we have to maintain that sort of support for hauliers. We'll have to look at food production more generally. But we hope this comes to an end sooner. No, we have supplies out till the end of April, I'm informed. And every month, you know, people are keeping this on a daily review. But we'll know later in April where we are for May.
Are we looking at fuel rationing?
We have, not at this stage, no. But everything's kept under review, Anton, because it's one shock after the other. But we have the NORA reserves. It's about 90 days supply there. So we're monitoring all of that, and we're having regular engagements with people in the field, in Minister O'Brien's department, Dara O'Brien's department, the Department of Energy. And the Secretary General of my department has convened a group of Secretary Generals of the key departments to keep a daily brief over this.
Are you happy that there hasn't been price gouging? Because one of the things that we get every morning when we discuss this is people saying, hang on a minute, there were excise reductions coming in. Why didn't I see them immediately at the pump? And why is it that whenever there is a reduction, it doesn't get passed on, but if there is an increase, it is instantaneous?
I think that those points are fair, although we have to try and balance it. Definitely when you bring it down the excise, some will have existing stock. You can see, particularly in rural areas, it might take some time to wash through the earlier stock, if you like. And we've asked the Consumer and Competition Authority to continue to maintain a weather vane eye and all of that to make sure.
And you're satisfied they're doing that sufficiently well?
I think they are, but we can never be certain in a volatile market like this. And I think when people see the contrast between different stations or different, you know, prices can vary, that tells its own tale.
Now, coming up towards the second half of this year, of course, is the EU presidency. That was viewed as something of a prize to look forward to. Has it become a poison chalice given what's happening internationally?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think it's a... First of all, it's our obligation as a member of the European Union. Every country takes up the presidency for 6 months. We're doing a lot of advanced work. It's also an opportunity, and we've put competitiveness as the number one item with values in terms of democracy and also security. Those are the three central priorities of our presidency. But on competitiveness, there's a view across Europe that we've overdone the regulation side of it, that we've made things too complicated. So there's an agenda called...
Well, sorry, can I go back for a minute? When you talked about the priorities, one of the expressed priorities I thought was strategic autonomy. That's a particularly tricky one.
That's not an Irish presidency objective. There are some in Europe who push strategic autonomy well, significantly. We're much more cautious in respect of that. We understand in some key industries, because of the experience in COVID, you need self-reliance. But we need to always be careful that doesn't drift into protectionism. So when we talk about competitiveness from the Irish perspective, or from a European perspective, it's about simplification of regulation. It's about a savings and investment union, which would be basically a capital markets union, but also enabling savings to be translated into investments for small to medium-sized companies.
Yeah, the Capital Markets Union has become like the integrated ticketing policy. And yes, Minister, we've talked about that now for two decades and nobody's got any closer to delivering.
But we're getting close to delivering. And in fact, I think during the Irish presidency, it's one of our goals that we'll bring that to a conclusion more or less by the end of the year. We also will be responsible for bringing the budget for the next 7 years for Europe to a conclusion by the end of our presidency. Enlargement is on the agenda. Montenegro is making huge progress. It's Ireland's objective that we would help to close most of the negotiating chapters for Montenegro so that they would be in a position to join within the next year or two. So we have clear set objectives on all of those, on those three pillar areas. Basically, what a presidency can do is you can drive on and enable and facilitate getting files closed and getting things done. And competitiveness will help us all in terms of jobs into the future.
What about on two central issues? One is the reshaping of the way the West is. And I mean, particularly going back to Donald Trump, the kind of comments that he made about former allies, about NATO, about France, about the UK. From that perspective, the role of the EU, what do you see as the challenge in the presidency in navigating that?
Well, I think in the EU member states, well, first of all, I think maintaining the transatlantic economic relationship is key, an overall relationship, absolutely key. I mean, the European Union, United States economic relationship is huge. It's enormous, biggest in the world. Ireland, the US is huge and enormous.
People, but we're both essentially price takers in that at this point, aren't we?
No, we're not. I mean, there's thousands of jobs in Ireland created out of it. We create thousands of jobs in America.
Except we're not treated as equal participants in the negotiations.
But you have to navigate every American presidency. And we're doing that quite well, despite all the noise. And you have to separate the noise from the substance. And Europe has navigated, I think, a difficult period well. But also then in terms of, like, I was in Finland and Poland on Monday, and in this part of the world we don't have the same appreciation of the anxiety and genuine fear of the Russian threat. Like, Finland spoke to me about a hard border, the entirety of the Finnish-Russian border, which is an enormous one. They had tourism, they had trade, that's all gone. They're spending huge money on security to defend themselves, just to secure their border, but also to protect themselves, make themselves more resilient on cyber attacks, which are regular, and all of that. And likewise in Poland, they've had a lot of hybrid attacks on their own soil. And again, they're in deficit. Both countries are in deficit now. Why? Because they're going to 5% defence spending. And we don't have that appreciation. So I believe the security...
But nor do we have the political will to do anything like similar spending. When you look at our security spending, when you look at our security capacity, even coming up on the European presidency, we are found wanting in almost every way, are we not?
We've come from a very low base. But actually, I think on cybersecurity, we've made very significant strides with the National Cybersecurity Centre. And we're continuing to make strides on that. And we work well with other countries in terms of collaborating and coordinating and sharing knowledge. And because...
Are we still going to have to borrow warships during the presidency?
No, we don't have to borrow anything but in that sense. But we can coordinate, we work with others, which makes sense. I mean, the world is a small place. And we do that anyway now, you know. I mean, we keep in close contact with our British counterparts, with European counterparts in terms of the Russian shadow fleet, for example, any threats to subsea cables. For us, economic security and security go hand in hand. So we have to protect our subsea cables. We have to protect gas interconnectors with Britain. We have to protect our companies against cyber attacks and our state utilities.
Do we have to get more involved in actively participating in the kind of developments in defence that other European member states do? For instance, things like dual use technology, does it need to be acceptable for organisations like Enterprise Ireland or the IDA to get into that space?
It does, actually. And we're saying, oh, yeah, we've facilitated that now, that companies, there's a huge defence industry out there. Companies should be in a position to contribute to that, or to create products that will be used by that. And for example,
and that's not difficult with neutrality, having the Irish state support companies that ultimately sell to militaries.
We have an army ourselves. I mean, I talked to the left and the Dáil on this. Do you think we should have an army? Well, actually, some on people who for profit are not never answered that clearly. I think some of them think we shouldn't.
Yeah, but there's a difference between having an army that is within the policy of neutrality and having
products
sold to active armies.
No, we spoke on Lebanon earlier. No, but I mean, you take research at the moment in terms of, when I was Minister of Defence, I went out to Baldonnel at an exhibition in terms of collaboration on research between science, what was in Research Ireland and the military. And what would they discuss? How to develop better technology to quench forest fires? Like, everything in the military defence world is malign.
Dual-use technology, ultimately, if it is being sold internationally, it is being sold to militaries who will use it in combat.
But we cannot isolate our own companies from the world around it in terms of the positive use of technology, as opposed to in defence and security terms, in terms of protecting people as well, which is the key issue. I mean, the big race is on how do we protect subsea cables? How do we stop someone from destroying them, which would be catastrophic.
But even in that, the answer financially is years away. Whatever about having a sonar to analyse what is going on, to actually be able to interdict malign action, we're miles away from that.
Well, not actually, depending on how you describe interdiction, or how you, because a lot of this is technology driven. A lot of it, you need very good mathematicians. You need a lot of people to spot anomalies. In cables, it's
you don't drive away a submarine with maths.
Well, sorry, no. Well, but first of all, if you don't have maths, you won't need a submarine there in the first place. You won't even know where to put the submarine. So it's not all hardware, and I've spoken to people on this. I'm not an expert on it, but it's a combination of brains having far better technology in identifying weaknesses in your infrastructure much earlier than you might otherwise. Your ships and so on can be deterrents. In terms of, for example, what went on in the Baltics, where anchors were dropped and tear up a cable or whatever like that. But it's much more complex than is understood more widely. But it's an area that I'm interested. So, for example, in terms of drones, and we have a very good centre in the University of Limerick that is developing underwater capability in terms of drone technology, which again can remotely controlled survey your cables, survey your interconnectors to make sure that they're safe and sound. And
but ultimately, doesn't it come down to having the military capacity to actually...
We will never be a military power
But surely we should be able to protect our own seaboard, no?
Of course, there's many ways to do that, is what I am saying. And we do it also because these cables are not just ours. They're shared between European colleagues, with British colleagues and so on like that.
A lot of text coming in. Let me put a couple of them to you. 65% of the price of petrol and diesel in tax. Why is it that we continue to take this in the teeth of a fuel crisis?
Well, we have reduced the taxes on fuel quite significantly, but tax revenue more generally funds our education service, funds our health service, funds all the other services that we have.
Poland's government has capped fuel prices. Why not do the same over here?
For us, we don't believe fuel capping would work, and it's an endless sort of commitment. We think what we've done so far makes sense. I think a more targeted approach is the way to go, to be frank with you. And I think we also are cautious because we don't quite know what's around the corner here. And in terms of how this war is going to continue, and we need to keep some firepower.
What about the Occupied Territories Bill and the expansion of it? Israel now occupying significant parts of Lebanon as well.
Yeah, but the Occupied Territories Bill won't affect Lebanon one way or the other. I do believe Israel in its behaviour is isolating itself. A lot of opinion around the world is very negative in terms of...
Does it care if it is American support?
It may not. And that is a deeply worrying situation because it's been particularly reckless. I mean, you saw the videos of the far-right minister, I think it was Ben-Gavir, in terms of the death penalty being passed. And the attitude there is, in my view, reckless and irresponsible.
Taoiseach, thank you very much. That is Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Thanks.
News Talk Breakfast with Anton Savage. In association with AIR. Weekday mornings at 7. News Talk. Conversation that counts.